Blog Talk Radio.
Suffering we endure for so little pleasure, mused the anchorite. What choice is left to the wise but to renounce? And so musing, just as the curse of old man winter was beginning to lift, and the first signs of life were returning to the lands of Bharata, the anchorite sat himself down at the foot of an ancient cherry blossom, revealing only the slightest hint of fleshy pink blossoms beneath the veil of green and newly sprung buds, nearly bursting with cleverly concealed colors, whispering promises of immortal beauty to the shifting winds. And so he sat, and so he would remain, he told himself, till sun burned his coiled wick to the very end and flickered out. And Earth fell from her orbit to sink like a time-polished river stone that she is through the timeless abyss, down, 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 forever. And life lived her last day before the fates, by their time-spun threads, drew her back to the void from which she had so brashly sprung so very long ago, and yoked her once more to the emptiness. Until that day, thought the anchorite, I will sit, for my will refuses to play this twisted game any longer, not one turn longer. A caterpillar inched along, quite unnoticed as it were, on an overhead branch, inched along till it found a location sufficiently satisfying and began to spin a silken tapestry finer than any human hand in all our eons have ever woven. And with this, the caterpillar wrapped itself round and round and so became a cocoon, not entirely unlike the incubating buds of the cherry blossom by which it made sanctuary. And some days later, just as the cherry blossoms were beginning to exploding into full bloom, so too the little caterpillar blossomed from that little cocoon into a creature of such grace and majesty that the hills themselves seemed to bow down before her, a butterfly, all eyes and iridescent colors, shimmering in the early morning sunlight. There was no other audience to reveal herself to. She fluttered before the closed eyes of the anchorite, radiating for all the lands of Bharata before the meditating ascetic. He didn't so much as lift an eyelid. She landed on his open palm and he lost focus, cracked a single earth-encrusted lid, and nearly wept for what he beheld. But it was just a ruse to lure him back into the world, the anchorite told himself, wise man that he was, a trick, and if he gave in now, it was only a matter of time before Samsara pulled him down her slippery slope as she had so many times before. He flicked his wrist and shooed the butterfly away. Shoo! Shoo! Without so much as a glance at the cherry blossoms flowering above his head, falling in their ripeness into his matted hair. And he closed his eyes to the many-colored world, that terrible, sensual, sin-riddled world, and retreated once more back within his own depths, as he hoped, as he prayed, forever. But the butterfly returned again and again, and always he shooed her away, again and again, shoo, 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 until at last she gave up and fluttered off in search of a more appreciative audience. The anchorite, meanwhile, had become so accustomed to shooing off the butterfly that it was a moment before he realized that she was no longer there. She had flown off to leave him alone, at peace, all to himself. And at the very click of the cosmic clock, a great gust was borne on the shifting winds that shook the ancient cherry blossom to its roots, causing a shower of pink petals to rain down upon the anchorite's matted hair. Chimes in every conceivable octave, and a few besides, rang through the underlying ether, speaking, as it were, of lost and hidden things, wondrous things. He heard it as thunder, as laughter, as water, as emptiness, as all of these and none, as something greater and more beautiful, as something intimate and more real. And he realized something he had never before suspected, and it struck him as a revelation, or a thunderbolt or a comet falling from the sky into his very lap. In words, it went something like this. All of creation is in love with me. I am in love with all of creation. We meet here and now as lovers. He stood up, took two uncertain steps, and fell face first into the dust under his severely atrophied legs, useless after so many days unused. Soon, however, as he began to massage the blood back into those withered extremities, he was able to walk again and run again, and he ran for all his life, as fast as his half-dead legs would carry him, skipping and tripping and crying out proclamations of glory, all in search of his butterfly. When at last he found her, not so very far away, she was imbibing nectar from a scarlet tulip in the singing meadow. It was warm and sunny, he noticed, and very pleasantly so, without a cloud in the sky, and just the right amount of breeze riding on the shifting winds. He sat down once more, but this time he kept his eyes open, and he watched her, and he loved her, and he marveled at it all. She fluttered before the gleaming sunbeams like an angel called down from the heavens just for him, and she landed upon his head and rested in his matted hair. Greetings and welcome to Zara Yana Radio. This is your host and humble storyteller, Evan Poss. And here we are in Cafe Fairfax, here with Daniel Michael. How are you doing, Daniel?
I am doing well.
Excellent. We've got a very special show for you guys today. I know the past weeks, for the most part, I've been reading the works of some of my favorite writers and myth makers. Today, I'm going to be reading a little bit of my own stuff. Sort of what I've been passed down and what I'm trying to pass along. And, you know, there's always a little bit of reservation for presenting one's own material. Of course, it's always closer to the heart, and we know painfully, painfully well how imperfect it is. You know, every flaw. That being said, these are things that can just sit around on my hard drive and collect digital rust, you know, forever. I haven't been sending them in recently, and, you know, I figure, although these are just stepping stones and, you know, they all have a lot of work to be done on them, certainly more fun reading what you've got. And you can sit on this stuff forever, and I'd really rather not. That first piece was, you know, all except for some editing. It's pretty much a one-sitting story. I just changed. I didn't really have a title for it, so I just came up with a working title yesterday. Although this is probably maybe a couple months old now. Petals falling gently. And so that is, that's that. And I'll be reading a piece that I spent a lot of time on, although not in a very long span of time. This is the first half of what I completed in approximately a month's time, in like January, February. Sent it into a couple of publications, you know, nothing took. Well, I'm not too surprised. There's, you know, it's going to take a lot of work, and it's by no means where it's where I want it to be at in the end. It's evolving every time I look at it. But it's pretty much just the product of 1 month of, you know, really nothing else other than working on this story. This will be like the first half of that, assuming we get through all of it. And before we get into that, I'm going to pass it over to Dan again, see if we got what's new on the Main Street Universe Network, what we got going with other shows, other hosts. We have a whole host of hosts now, and it's a very exciting time here. What do you got for us, Dan?
Yes. Of course, on Wednesdays is the flagship show, Main Street Universe, the one that started us going. And, of course, today at 11 a.m., both these shows are daytime shows here on the East Coast, 11 a.m. Today's Ariana Radio. We also have Walking on the Sidewalk, A Horizon Oracle's Journey with Kevin Baird at 6 o'clock in the evening. And then that night, on Friday nights, midnight, Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour with Jesse Ann Nichols George. Sunday nights we often use as a miscellaneous night, a night where we go on and do readings, or if we have a special guest that can't make it on one of the other shows, we keep Sunday open for that sort of thing, as of now, unless some really amazing host would come along to take Sunday. But right now I like keeping it open as a kind of a optional night. But we almost, recently we've been still going on the air on Sunday nights a lot. I did this last week. And we have a future guest coming up in about 2 weeks. And his name is Reverend Donald E. Robinson. And he started a nonprofit called Beacon House in D.C. So once a month, to clarify, we're going to be having someone from a charity or nonprofit come on and talk about what they do. And he's, so the first one, who I'm going to have a continuing on-air relationship with, hopefully. In fact, we might go to his location in D.C. And it's a pretty amazing organization that has even had a championship football team before. So it's a place for at-risk children between the ages of 5 and 18 to go and get further school. There's tutoring programs, and there's even, like I said, a sports teams that they have of their own. That's how large and successful they become, to where they compete with other, like, schools and other organizations. Their football team, I think 2 years ago, won I think, what is the Pee Wee football? I forget what the league is called, but it's for children. They won the championship, which is pretty impressive for a non-profit group to put together a championship football team, which you need a lot of people to put a football team together.
That,
that takes like 80 people or something like that. I mean, it's not an easy undertaking. But he felt like there was a void in D.C. There's also even classes on nutrition. And again, it's like tutoring, it's extra schooling, and a bunch of different programs. And you can look it up at beaconhouse.org. I posted it on the Main Street Universe Facebook page yesterday. So I look forward to having a continuous, like once a month, whatever seems to feel natural, sort of updates on certain charities and social justice work, because I've always said that I wanted Main Street Universe to be a community show, and all the different hosts do all the different things, but the flagship show, Main Street Universe, was meant to be community, art, as well as issues of the day sometimes, as well as things like sometimes we just do divinations, readings, rituals, but it's meant to be a community show as well, as part of the mission statement. And so I've been contacting different organizations to stay with that. So that's what's coming up in the future. And there are other ones too, but that's one that I know about 2 weeks he'll probably be on the show. So we're setting that up, as well as lots of other things. I have lots of other guests that I won't announce on the air yet. They've said yes, but some of them are fairly well known in their field, but don't want to announce them until I have a date set. So that's what's going on.
All right, excellent. So we're going to dedicate the rest of the show. The story I was mentioning earlier. And since I kind of imagine this being in three parts, this being part one, of course, you know, this is there's a good deal of part two as well. It's you know, one of those things where the story is in the mind, but it hasn't fully come down onto the paper yet. It's called Beneath the Black Banyan. Beneath the Black Banyan. Part one. As above, so below. The three worlds form one city of mine, and Kashi is my royal palace therein. From the Skanda Purana. Every night I dream of the upper canopy, and every morning, reality insists, you can't get there from here. The metropolis of Kashi, like the six other major metropolitan centers of Bharata, rises above samsara like a lotus, its roots buried deep in the muck, its petals blossoming into the heaven realms, a marvel of civil engineering and human ingenuity. We call it the canopy, from down here in the muck. The canopy is stratified according to a vertical hierarchy, to the effect that you can only travel as high as your caste permits. Access yantras are distributed based on merit and allow for travel to higher and lower levels via the nadi system. The Brahmins occupy the highest branches of the canopy. They represent the augury of Bharata, communing with gods and goddesses in the heaven realms and inculcating their virtues into the lower strata of society. This is where most of Kashi's 333,000 temples are located. The most pious among the lower caste receive access yantras to enter the heaven realms on certain days, at certain times, to make their offerings of coin and harvest, and to receive darshan, to see and be seen by the god who dwells within all gods. from observation bubbles extending out from the highest branches, Jyotishi astrologers travel to distant worlds, orbiting distant stars. Bharata's interstellar ambassadors, discussing galactic politics with representatives of other spacefaring civilizations over Chai. The middle canopy represents the political sector of society, and never a more convoluted sector there was. Here we find the Kshatriyas, handsome rajas and well-fed wazirs, bureaucrats and Bogacorp billionaires, policy magi and karmic fundamentalists, pistachio generalismos, dharma wardens, head nodders, and the like. If the Brahmin's attention can be said to focus upward, the Kshatriya's attention can surely be said to focus downward. After all, it is the dharma of the Kshatriyas to uphold the dharma of the lower and less fortunate strata, as it is handed down by the Brahmins, as it is handed down by the gods, as it is handed down by the infinitely regressing one. And so, in theory at least, the dharma trickles down. The lower canopy, occupied by the Vaishyas, the merchants and artisans of Bharata, represents the business and economic sector of the great canopy. It hosts shopping malls and pleasure centers, bazaars and brothels, souks, sex emporiums, and all manner of free trade and commerce. Kshatriyas are occasionally known to condescend into the lower canopy for cheap food and cheap thrills, but most of the business here comes from Shudras, who, by their outstanding commitment to the Dharma, have earned for themselves and their families access yantras, allowing them to emerge from the lower levels on certain days at certain times to trade in their abysmal wages for the fishhook necessities of life and perhaps a pleasure or two. The high risers, as we call them, serve as the trunks of the lofty canopy, sinking as they do into the miasma of samsara and lifting the civilized world into the heaven realms. They possess healthy coats of bark, formed by the accumulated plasterings of Bogacorp advertisements for Thumbs Up Cola and shitty internet service. Here dwell the Shudras, the dispossessed, the unseen laborers of the colony. Domiciles, workstations, cafeterias, recreation halls, and latrines all thread together within the stark cement walls of the high-risers, each a self-contained world capable of efficiently synthesizing essential building blocks for the expansion of the canopy and supplying them to the extremities via the nadi system. And beneath even the Shudras, in the shanties that sprout like lichen and fungi from the canopy floor, in the most wretched of all hell realms, here abide the outcasts and the untouchables and the shandalas, the denizens of ground-level samsara, through which the immaculate river runs black. In my case, home. I was running errands for Babaji, slipping through an abandoned side street that doubled as an open-air sewer for the residents of the adjacent high-risers, when karmic clockwork launched me headlong into the agori. The collision nearly spilled me out into the sewage. Bilva leaves and sandal paste fell from my hand, and a coconut rolled over an overflowing dumpster, startling some small feral creature. It hissed, a venomous hiss, back arched, tail raised, scales ruffled, before scurrying down an open drainpipe. The naked agori put on a toothy smile. His presence was as tangible and uncompromising as the walls of the high-riser. Aside from the human ash he wore over his skin like sunblock, his only adornments were dreadlocks, rudraksha beads, and a festering human skull he wielded as a begging bowl. I considered my escape when his left hand fell on my shoulder. I squirmed in my sandals. Hello there, little Swami. Time holds no compulsion over those of the cloth. Is that not what they teach you? So tell me, what great haste excuses you from respecting a skull bearer? I'm afraid this old bowl of mine is falling apart, actually. He held it up for me to see. I lose half my gruel before I can finish a meal, and I've been meaning to procure a new one. Speak, child. Whose errands do you run, and to what end? I was procuring sacraments for my Babaji, I somehow managed through chattering teeth. Tonight is Shivaratri. Ha! Tonight is Shivaratri, the Holy of Holies, and I gather from your choice of sacraments that Babaji knows nothing of its true meaning. Honestly, bilva leaves and coconut, what is matter and metaphor to Lord Shiva? Shiva is pure consciousness. Your Babaji is clearly an idiot. You waste precious time to spend such an auspicious night under such a stupid guru. He paused, as though reflecting. Only a child of Agori blood would make shortcuts of these decrepit causeways. And I can see desire this power I yield, to yoke the goddess to your will as I have. The lust is written in your eyes. It belongs to no man, and it can be yours too. You know the lore of the night, do you not? I nodded, cautiously raising my eyes to meet his. Vermilion light was collecting within his hungry sockets. Again I thought of escape, but the light drew me in with the gravity of a collapsing star, and I was hooked. The smile returned, a waning crescent, cruel as the Bharata sun. The fluorescent bulbs hanging over the causeway began to flicker and grow dim as the air around the Agori took on an electric charge. Clouds gathered above our heads, and sparks danced in circles around our feet. Closing his eyes and inhaling, the Agori began unfolding his form, diffusing and expanding, drawing all matter and energy into his vortex as a djinn might coalesce out of some uncorked copper vessel. Horns sprouted from his ash-smeared forehead, growing up, outwards and up, thick as banyan roots. Discharges of red lightning cackled from his eyes and fingertips. He roared thunder. Windows and fluorescent bulbs shattered in unison. Bass rattled the alloy beams of the high-risers, and the putrid earth shook and bubbled beneath my feet, threatening to swallow me whole. I fell to my knees, hands over my ears, thinking my head must surely explode, if not from the decibels, then surely from the pressure. And a voice not my own, spoke from within my guarded depths, a voice of spiderlings hatching into the crevices of cognition. The voice of plague and pestilence and infestation. The voice of life streaming backwards down eternity's drainpipe and compelling beyond all comprehension. Join us tonight, Asti, beneath the canyon. And in a flash, it was over. The Agori and his phantasmagoria were gone. Perhaps they never were. Fluorescent bulbs droned ever onwards. Windows sat in their respective sills. Lights and sounds, all as they should be. My ears were ringing like temple bells in a procession. But I counted my blessings, fetched the coconut, wiping it clean on my ochre robes, and made my way back towards the ashram. As I walked, following the banks of the Immaculate River, as she flows black beneath the kingdom of Kashi, I contemplated my encounter with the skull bearer. The lore of the night he referred to was this, of Shiva Ratri, the knight of Shiva. It is said that the great lord bestows his darshan upon those who pass the night completely sleepless. Not a wink, not even a nod. And trickster that he is, Shiva is known for devising all manner of device for lulling his bhaktas to sleep. The Shiva bhaktas in turn ingest copious quantities of bhang, a potent concoction of ganja, datura, and God knows what else, shed their clothing as the dead shed the flesh, and run wild through the streets of Kashi. So the Bharata sun rises on his golden chariot to dispel the horde, smiting those ghouls and goblins into warm, sleepy submission with a wave of his royal scepter. The greater Kashi metropolis is host to hundreds, if not thousands, of cremation grounds in the lower levels of Samsara. It is said of Kashi that it is the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world. In that span of time, all manner of things have risen up from the dust and fallen back to it. But the fact of life remains death. And so the carnal grounds have stood the test of time, proliferating with the proliferation of our species. I knew of the Black Banyan, although it was not well known. It was the cremation ground for those of us who dwelt on the far shore of the Immaculate River. For those of us who could not afford the illustrious send-off of Kashi's famed burning ghats. The Black Banyan was a young tree when the first humans settled here. Refugees of the Battle of Kurukshetra, at the end of the last Yuga, at the death of the last Avatar. Now, the Kali Yuga too is ending, and as far as anyone can tell, our Avatar is yet to hit the scene. Only a couple hundred thousand more solar years till the Destroyer returns to unrot creation and initiate the rebirth of the Golden Yuga. We are so close. Zarashwaram, as it is known, is located on the far shore of the Immaculate River, in the sacred grove just downstream from the Sprawl, where the waters of civilization's teat run black beneath the canopy of Kashi. It is both a temple and an ashram for the downtrodden denizens of ground-level Samsara, the tribals and the untouchables and the Shandalas. It is said that Zarashwaram was originally the temple of Asya, the scribe. But with the building of the canopy over Kashi, all the literati moved up to roost in the branches, and few remained below who cared to worship at the temple of the scribe. And so it was abandoned. And so it remained until the arrival of the prophet Ashtika. He reclaimed the millennia-old temple and founded, here in the very bowels of Bharata, the lineage of Zarashwaram. His life and his deeds remain mostly a mystery. Even in his own time, it seems very little was known of the man the Brahmins labeled the false prophet. It is said that his funeral pyre burned in the shadows of the Black Banyan. The atmosphere at Zarashwaram was unusually festive that morning. Garlands of red and white lotuses picked the dawn from the nearby sewers. Hung from the walls were framed pictures of saints and mystics whose lineage we carried. Over the many shrines and murtis scattered across temple grounds. Sweet and heavy smoke filled the stone corridors. Hashish and sandalwood and the smells of the river all blending together seamlessly in the dank temple air. One of the older swamis caught me and charged me with smearing the murtis with sandal paste and splashing them with kumkum. I repressed certain thoughts and fell to the task. This sentiment generally summarized my experience of the ashram. It was either this or the streets of samsara. And so I repressed certain thoughts and fell to the task. And honestly, it should have been fun, but it was not fun. Not for me, not while I could still dream of the upper canopy and the life I would never know that awaits me if only I could dream deeper. Deeper. Babaji was discoursing on Kashmir Shaivism in the meditation hall, expounding upon the 20 immortal sutras of the Pratyabhinja Hridayam with wit and wisdom befitting the great Lord himself. At times, I could not be certain that it wasn't from Shiva's own lips that the sermon flowed forth into my cognitive estuary, nectar flooding the shallow banks of my identity. A recognition of the bliss of awareness. If you wish to reclaim sovereignty over your creative faculties, you must first surrender both your attractions and your repulsions. Each is a chain with which you bind one foot and the other to the floor of samsara. Reality is a cause and effect mechanism, isn't it? If a person is repulsed, the repulsion is always triggered by some causal stimuli, isn't it? Things are not in and of themselves possessed of the qualities with which the creative faculties cover them. There is no repulsion in samsara. There is no attraction, no color, no sound, no scent, no love, no pain, no suffering, no anything. So what is the source of the repulsion, of the attraction? What is the source of love? Awareness must be traced back beyond its manifestations to its root nature in bliss. Bliss is the opening of closed eyes and the myriad possibilities. But I was restless. I couldn't wait. I needed to find the black banyan. We sat for meditation, but my mind would not be reined in. Intoxicated as it was with unformulated desires, I was in no mood for struggling, so I surrendered and let the deluge flow from its floodgates. Visions came, dancing upon the face of the deep. I sink. The cosmic waters engulf another drop, and I am no longer one among the many, but many among the one. My depths cannot be delved, my heights summited. Beginning and end are lost amidst the endless coils. Vague outlines of scales and leviathan girth contrast the darkness and bring it into perspective. Inexplicably, I am overcome with immense joy. The vision recedes into the darkness. A red serpent slithering up a tree. I reach out to grab it, and she strikes my hand. I retract, more reflex than will, and I find two red puncture marks just above the knuckles. I know that venom travels faster through the bloodstream as heart rate and blood pressure increase. So I remain calm. I breathe. I breathe deeper. Deeper and deeper still. Deep as the cosmic ocean. And I just stop. But the mind. The mind is still active. I recall the legends of the yogis of ages past who put spectacled cobras to their hands and tongues and let them strike, transmuting that lethal venom into nectar within their veins. I recall Shiva's blue neck as he drinks the hala hala poison at the churning of the Milky Ocean, an act of universal compassion from the destroyer of worlds. Embrace the venom, give thanks, and pass on. A thousand-petaled white lotus. I am seated within its center. I crawl forward to look, to peep over the edge, and behold its great green stalk coiling gently. Oh, so very gently, down into an emptiness beyond the boundaries of my vision. I look up, and an opening appears in the emptiness. I think to move closer, and the lotus moves me closer. I think to move through and within, and the lotus grows up and up, higher and higher, until the opening hangs just above my crown. The lotus rises into the opening. I find myself in a temple of light. Glowing shrines line the walls, beneath columns and archways lavished unto minutia, non-Euclidean domes and glass atrium courtyards entertain the starry heavens with hanging pleasure gardens and dancing Apsara fountains wrought from purest quartz crystal recite their unending litanies of running water. In the center of it all, a well seems to lead nowhere at all. The air is sweet with jasmine and sandalwood, and the faraway music of the Gandharvas proclaims the glory of their goddess. I made my way around the well to the far side of the temple and entered the womb room. The murti was of Zara. Zara, my beloved. Seated in Padmasana, atop the thousand-headed hood of Sesha, the never-ending serpent, the umbilical arc of the self-programming goddess. Even as I look on in wonder, a cascade of white light flows down from the starry heavens, descending into the murti and filling Zara with her divine presence. As the white light floods into the bronze-casted vessel, it diffracts, overflowing from her cosmic sockets in meandering rivers of rainbow light, emptying blissfully into the fertile mangroves growing within the estuary of awareness, nourishing all that it shines upon. Zara Darshana, to see and to be seen by Zara. The processor goes blank, and I fall backwards, headlong down the well, down, down, down. I fell forever. When I stopped falling, I was in the bowels of Bharata. All around me were the colossal roots of the world tree, filling up the space between the roots where, presumably, soil should have been. Fertile earth, Mother Earth. There was trash, plastic, landfill spanning millennia. A voice sounds from above to clean up, to clean up. It was a girl's voice. The illusion fell away and I was standing in front of a Naga shrine, or Nagini rather, beneath an old banyan, not the black banyan, but one that I did recognize It was close to the ashram, just downriver, overlooking a bathing ghat. The voice spoke from the tree, "Come to me." And the voice spoke my name, Asti. And the voice repeated, "Come to me, Asti. Come to me, Asti. Come to me, Asti." And I looked up and saw a young girl sitting in the branches of the banyan. She put her hands around her mouth and shouted, "Now!" My body nearly jumped out of its skin. It took nearly all of my strength to maintain composure as my psyche snapped back into its material vessel. I hadn't moved a muscle, lifted an eyelid. My back ached and my knees needed rotating. And I knew then exactly what I needed to do. I cracked my eyelids, ever so slightly, scanning the room for any sign of wakefulness or activity. The room was absolutely still, every consciousness drawn in upon itself. No one would notice. Babaji would notice, but I had to risk it. He seemed to be asleep. I wondered if he slept through midday meditation often, and decided he probably did. As silently as I could, I picked up my straw mat, stacked it along the back wall, and I cracked the door until I had just enough space to slink my lanky frame through and was gone. I was making for the back gate through the vegetable garden when a voice over my shoulder stopped me like a runaway statue. "A bit young to be transgressing our vows, aren't we?" I turned slowly to face him, head down, awaiting the crack of the Dharma stick. I chose to concentrate on his feet, which were dark, wrinkled, and possessed of unusually long toenails. Just as I was about to prostrate before those remarkable feet and beg forgiveness, he placed a hand on my shoulder and called me up. The gaze I beheld then was as unfathomable as the black depths of space. To my relief, he finally relented, and his eyes smiled for him. "Why should I stop you? You will as you will. Don't forget to have fun, boy. Happy Leela." And so saying, Babaji pulled from his robe a gleaming kris. Her moonlight blade winding like the river Luna. Her handle was bone inlaid with silver and pigeon blood rubies, depicting a pattern of two intertwined serpents, each consuming the tail of the other. I thought to inquire of the species whose bone this once was, and thought better of it. This was a human bone. Babaji smiled upon me, knowingly and beneficent. I stashed the weapon in the fold of my ochre robes, prostrated, and took off into the dying light of day. Let's take a little intermission here. Intermission.
Okay, I'm back from behind the drum kit. I see Selena Ayers is there. Hello, see you in the chat room. We're away from the computer a lot today, folks, so if someone calls, we may not be able to get to him because I'm behind the drum kit.
Right, right. And.
But right now I'm in front of the computer.
That's okay because we're in story mode right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we'll see you in the chat room right now because I'm back from behind the kit. And when he starts the next story, I shall be returning to the drum kit. And this is some of Evan's original material, which he has very interesting and descriptive style that I can see the influences.
I want to thank everyone listening right now, everyone in the chat room, everyone joining us live, everyone who will be joining us later this week, and listening to those archives. It's great to have you here. Really appreciate it. You can't tell a story without an audience.
We're going to take a brief musical interlude and be right back.
What we're hearing there is a piece called Interspace Shuttle, something I worked with my really good friend Ben, amazing teacher, up and coming. You'll be hearing more of him, especially in the show. And we were taking a brief intermission from a story I worked on. I started, I think, in January, spent about a month on it. And it's just, you know, kind of been sitting around ever since. It's kind of the product of, like, there's a lot of work that went into this before that month. Although, you know, without having any of this written, you could say world creation, you know, character development, gods and goddesses, you know, like setting the mythos, creating the scenery. So that had, you know, those elements have been in a process for some time prior. And I think, I don't remember where it was, sitting in the passenger seat, driving with someone somewhere. And I can't for the life of me remember, but, you know, we're talking at least a several-hour drive. And the story just started unfolding in my mind as I, you know, staring out the window on the highway. And it just, you know, like more and more of it started coming, and I, you know, got home, immediately hopped on my computer and started typing as fast as my fingers would type. And, you know, it just kind of started like that. I think that's how a lot of the best stories start. You know, I can't tell you how many hours I've spent sitting in front of my blank computer screen like, all right, now I'm going to start a new story. Eventually you get something, but, you know, the story's got to come to you, I think.
I agree.
Dan agrees. That's what
I think. I think it's harder than songwriting. I think it's a little more difficult because I try to write too. I'm not as well read as Evan is, but I find, you know, fiddling around with my guitar and coming up with a song is easier because eventually something in the notes will just inspire a song or a riff or a hook. Whereas when it's just a story, it's like you're creating the entire world. It's not necessarily being backed up by the instrument, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing. So usually, a lot of times I get my story ideas from dreams. And I had one the other night. I won't go into now because I want you to continue on with your thing. But I have one that I want to start that came from a dream. It, like you said, it came to me. And I read it by a few people, and they thought it was kind of a cute idea. So I might go with it. So here you go.
Thank you, Dan. And absolutely, dreams. What better source for stories have we than our dreams? We live out our own stories in those, you know, in those realms which we cannot quite define. Whatever it is, it makes for a good story. All right, so let us continue back into the land of Bharata. As we continue in part one, Beneath the Black Banyan. I found her sitting in the branches of the banyan, exactly as I had seen in the vision. Her skin was as dark as night, her hair more tangled than a thorn bush, and her eyes... Well, her eyes. What profane words could I possibly spew forth to convey the perfection contained within those overflowing depths? In all the three worlds, the seven heavens and the seven hells, through the Akashic records, forwards and back, past, present, and future, and into that most intangible of all realms, Zara's interspace. the living, sentient void from which Sara weaves, on warp and woof, her transcendental tapestries, dyed as they are, of space and time, light and sound, order and chaos. Spinning on her ontological loom, the unending fabrics upon which all creatures play their little games, knowing them only as realities. For those eyes, alas, such words I concede I do not possess. No easy admission for a self-professed teller of the tale. I didn't know where else to begin. Namaste, I called up into the tree. The God in me sees the God in you. Namaskar, came the reply. Likewise. Mind if I join you up there? She shook her head and giggled. I won't bite. My friend was here, she told me, as I settled myself next to her. I didn't understand what she meant. She pointed to the Nagini Murti at the base of the tree, a vine-tangled stone relief of that exquisite creature. Woman from the hips up, serpent from the hips down, surmounted by the telltale hood. Her name is Ulupi. I come here sometimes to visit her. Isn't she a beautiful tree? She is indeed. We kicked our feet in the open air. She was once the lover of Arjuna, the hero, in the days of the battle of Kurukshetra. But as they say, trees live longer than heroes. So now she passes her days and nights alone, always giving more than she receives. An immortal widow. I am the only one who ever visits her, except for the occasional housewife asking a child, or the occasional washerwoman asking her dead son back from the river, or the occasional farmer offering a bowl of milk in exchange for the rains. But that's only occasionally. Mostly she passes the eons alone. But she is very nice. You would like her. I agreed that I would. I saw you in a vision, you know. Just like you are now. In this very banyan tree, I knew exactly where to find you. I know. I was calling you. Calling me? But you don't even know me. I know. Then why were you calling me? I don't know. I see. I didn't. What now then? Well, what are your plans for Shivaratri? I started telling her about my run-in with the Agori that morning and how I was expected beneath the black banyan. Her eyes glazed over, and her posture went slightly slack. Akula? How fun. Can I come, Asti? I don't see what... Great! I'll lead the way. At that, she leapt from the branch and caught a strangler vine, slid to its end, and hit the ground running. What in Samsara's web she was making for the black banyan. I felt like an idiot descending the trunk 1 foot at a time, but I figured I'd make up the distance on foot. Plus, I knew where she was going. I took a shortcut. She came around the corner just as I expected. I caught her wrist and threw her against the high-riser wall. I noticed then she carried some heavy object wrapped in a sash that she wore slung over her shoulder. I buried the question for later. So you know my name, but I must have missed yours. Her smile was straight mischief. Banyan. You know the black banyan, I take it? I live beneath its shadow. Reality was losing its touch. I felt her being dragged away from me, as though pulled by some unseen thread. I held her tight. Diagori? My brother. What's left of him. I see. Though not any more than I did before. And your parents? The groundskeepers. At first, I thought it was just I was just imagining it. But her feet were starting to run, and I couldn't hold her back. She looked into my eyes, and I realized she was crying. You must help me, Asti. You must. We took off running. I wouldn't let go, so I was dragged along faster than my feet could carry me, towards the Black Banyan. I managed to gain an extra step on her and kicked her feet from under her, so we both came tumbling into the mud. Tell them, I gasped. We both come willingly. They know, she cried. They know. They let us walk at our own pace the rest of the way, although occasionally we would feel a little tug, and we would tug back. And I now understood it. The groundskeeper sent their daughter out to find me, just as they had sent out her older brother, Diagori. She wanted to escape, but they had threaded her through with mantras and binding spells. She told me herself what a little good it did. She was just a piece of bait, and they had me hooked. Perhaps they hooked me when I ran into Diagori that morning. Perhaps I was hooked unwittingly. That time so many seasons passed, when I pelted the old groundskeeper wife with a river stone. Perhaps I carry this hook from long-forgotten lies, long ago lived. What difference did it make now? Ask not how you came to be hooked. Just unhook yourself. Asti, she said after we'd been walking for some time, I have a secret. Will you share it with me? I feel I must tell somebody. Anybody. There's no one else to tell. I would think you have more secrets than one, but sure. What's your secret, Banyan? It's the thing tied up in my sash. I was going to ask about that. I dug it up this morning from beneath the Black Banyan. You dug it up? Yep, dug it up. I think it's a ruby, or something better. See, I've had the same reoccurring dream as far back as I can remember. I am digging up the roots of the Black Banyan. When I see red shining out of the earth, I dig and dig and finally pull out a glowing red gemstone. Size of a small coconut. After that, the dream varies. Sometimes the shock of the stone is too great to maintain the dream, and I wake up. Sometimes the stone works powerful magic through me, and I manifest my will as I will it. While still in the dream, you know? Sometimes the Black Banyan goes up in flames as I pull the stone from out her roots. These variations are more common, but I have seen others. Once. Do you think they can hear us? I glanced over my shoulder. Hear our conversations, I mean, or our thoughts? I doubt it, but even if they could, it wouldn't matter now. It's all in the threads now, isn't it? What will happen will happen. Banyan fell silent. I had to prompt her. So you dug it up? Hmm? Oh, yes. Just this morning. I waited for them to go to sleep for the day, being nocturnal and all. And I grabbed a shovel and began to dig. I knew exactly where. By mid-morning, I held it in my hands, just as I had seen it in my dreams a million times. I tied it in my sash, as I knew I would, and ran off to hide with the loopy. No one else knows I have it, just us. I have this intuition about it. I think somehow it belongs to me. The sun was fallen, and the sacrificial flames kindled when we arrived at the burning grounds. The tree was larger than I remembered. Ghosts and elementals swam through its branches as fish through a reef. And the Ganas gathered round the flames to dance the dance of their lord. Dakinis lounged languid on puffs of conjured cloud, rendered sideways by the weight of the opulent fertility karma causes them to carry upon its life and lanky frames, eagerly awaiting the ceremonies. Zombies and skeletons fraternized over shots of bong, which they drank from little plastic cups, leaning on maces and tridents and battle axes. Goblins were cutting bodies down from the tree and preparing them for the ritual. A yeti was lurking somewhere in the dark, just out of sight, but you couldn't miss him. You wait here. I've got to talk with my parents. Banning pointed towards a small outlying shelter. I'll be in there. It's a home of sorts. Talk to people. Don't be awkward. The shelter was a thing of mud bricks, plastic tarps, and PVC. It had three chimneys and no windows. The crew of Rakshasas strolled over, their smilodon tusks polished to a shine, looking at me as if they had never seen a real human before. Their friends were laughing from a safe distance. So I hear there's supposed to be a kula tonight. I tried to make small talk. Where'd you hear that, meatbag? Started a pudgy raksha up front, smoking a cigar between ice-pick canines and brandishing a trident he clearly intended to impale me with the first chance he got. Well, you know, a little serpent told me. He blew a puff of black smoke into my face. Well, a little serpent might just get her little kneecaps broken for that. A taller rakshasa spoke from behind a pudgy one. If only we could have that kind of fun, Subahu. Unfortunately, for all of us, I think, tonight is by the books. The boss has need of their bodies. Until then, we can't touch them. You mean we can't even rough them up? Whined the pudgy one called Subahu. Not even a little? How about a cigar burn? Not even a cigar burn? I would let you burn me with a cigar if it was up to me. Honestly, I thought I'd be on the roasting spit already. This isn't going to take all night, is it? Funny. I was just thinking how good you would look on a spit. He turned to the taller rakshasa for the go-ahead and was shot down with a look. He grumbled. Really, I don't like this any more than you fellas. Anything to pass the time, am I right? We were playing dice when Banning returned. She came up silently and whispered in my ear, "It's time to go, Asti." I looked into her eyes and saw fear, raw and unprocessed. I looked into my pile of winnings and saw a small kingdom. Mortal's luck, they call it. I grabbed a ring and an amulet. Oh, and a gold coin. It seemed the thing to do. She squeezed my hand. Please, we need to go. It's been fun, fellas. Keep the change. Then I stood up and looked around. All glowing eyes were on us. You still leading the way? It was too late. They had us surrounded, and the ritual was about to begin. I pulled the kris from out my ochre robes. Thought processes were going haywire. Terror had turned me stupid. Banyan placed her hand on my arm. Rather calmly, I thought, "Sheathe your blade. We won't need it. Not yet." She untied her sash and unraveled it. It fell forward. It fell towards her hands, but remained suspended just above her skin, floating. A glowing red orb the size of a small coconut. The Rakshasas were closing in on us, weaving webs of enchantment through our minds and through our hearts. The Banyan uttered a mantra into the glowing red orb, and with an unseen scythe fell legions of Lord Shiva's minions, hacking us a path through the field of death. A bull-horned Raksha king stepped out from the shelter, followed by two withering cases of humanity. She tied up her sash, orb glowing red through the fabric. Now we run. We reached the bathing ghats without a click to spare, vaulted the steps, and slipped headlong into the underground sewer system. The water, if you could call it water, came up to our ankles. We could hear them clambering down the steps above us, weapons of nightmare in hand and claw. We followed the only available path into the dripping abyss. Eventually, we were spit out into a vast cavern of pipes and passageways, towering sewage falls and bottomless water tanks, damned knotty channels, abandoned maintenance tunnels, and 1,001 comings and goings too insignificant to mention. A giant lumbering mechanisms. Giants lumbering mechanisms upheld the Dharma according to their programming. Gears and cogwheels and sprockets, all dancing in unison, turning and churning, spilling and surging, clicking, ticking, and burping to the beat of Kashi's digestive clockwork. The veritable bowels of Bharata. Behind us, grunting and a splashing of heavy footsteps, announced the approach of the Rakshasas. We climbed up into a jungle of pipes and found a hidden corner on a platform overlooking the cavern. Banyan had that look of mischief about her. She gave me a nudge, as if to say, "Watch closely. This trick is for you." Without unraveling her sash, without uttering a sound, Banyan began pronouncing her mantras. Just as the Rakshasas were filtering in, Banyan pointed out her spy view, and I followed her finger. On the floor of the cavern, hiding from the Rakshasas behind a scum-glazed cistern, I saw two children, identical to Banyan and me, identical to Banyan and myself in every way, except, perhaps, ontologically. The Rakshasas were preparing to split up and search the cavern. Banyan uttered an unspoken syllable, and the illusory Asti and the illusory Banyan took off like the hunted down one of the many sewage tunnels, running for their illusory lives, illusory sandals triggering illusory splashes that echoed over the drudge and gurgle of the cavern. The Rakshasas took the bait, almost too easy. Subahu, the runt of the pack, was sent back to guard the cavern. Resentfully, considering it a waste of his potential, he crawled up onto a dry platform, kicked back under a jungle of pipes, and fell asleep. Trident resting between his folded arms, he began to snore. Can you guess which platform the pudgy Rakshasa fell asleep on? Not for the first time that night, and certainly not for the last. I resigned myself to death, or some worse fate. Banyan, however, was bubbling over with mirth. She kept winking at me. My comprehension failed, and I gave a lame shrug, but somehow her eyes convinced me. She pronounced a short, inaudible mantra, approached the ugly brute, and knelt to wipe the drool dripping from his precious tusks. Then she pulled a few glow-in-the-dark markers from out of her tattered rags and started coloring them in with hearts and butterflies and floral patterns. When she finished, Banyan stashed the markers in his cigar pouch, and we booked it down the largest and most terrible tunnel of all. The long abandoned Nadi channel, spanning the breadth of the river from below. How long will that illusory us hold up for? I asked to pass the time, realizing only too late that I didn't care to know the answer. Not sure, until they catch us, I think, or until they realize they had lost the thread. The sewer I sent us down opens into the river just above Zarishwaram, exactly where they would expect us to go. Instead, we cross under the river and disappear into the shanties. The faintest of vermilion glows emanated from the sash slung over Banyan's shoulder, a last light of awareness. If this was the right tunnel, it should gradually pan out into a basin and slope back to the surface on the other side. We reached the edge of the basin and saw, in the faintest of vermilion glows, a shimmering, reflecting surface that stopped us dead. The tunnel was flooded. Then we noticed the old man. Then we noticed the old man huddled inside a cardboard nest at the water's edge, mostly skeleton, the living, breathing husk, wore a pair of dusty sunglasses, shook an empty tin cup that it made no noise whatsoever. Drop the gold coin I won from the Rakshasas into his empty cup.